Talk given Friday, 16th November, 1973. Day before yesterday, a royal wedding took place. I wonder what we, the people, thought and felt as we perhaps witnessed it on TV or had a seat in Westminster Abbey, as the case may be, or stood outside or read about it in the papers or heard about it on the radio and listened to the folk talking. What are the reactions of all of us to an event like that? And I picked upon the royal wedding because, being such a important a national occasion, it may perhaps call forth much more reaction or response from us, the people, than the wedding of Jack Smith in the next town might. What are these reactions like? Do they make a little lump rise in one's throat? Or a little furtive tear steal down one's eyes? Does it call up memories? What sort of memories? Is there a clutching in one's heart? A little tension at one's solar plexus? And if so, why? What is the origin of these things? Was it just sheer excitement, pleasure? Or was there criticism, anger? Royalty can afford all this. What about the millions of the poor who can't? So much public money spent upon it and all that. Why the criticism? Why the judgment? Why, in short, the hate? Any jealousy? Any nostalgia? Any envy? All sorts of things rise up in our minds and hearts at the events which take place in daily life. Some of these reactions are very strong, some are superficial. Are we really mindful of these reactions? And an event like marriage produces a considerable emotional upheaval in most people. It is associated with our conditioning right from childhood onwards, which makes us believe that here is the supreme happiness, the supreme pleasure, and the supreme happiness and fulfillment will come out of this. And our reactions and responses and feelings are so tied up with what we ourselves have experienced, whether in terms of fulfillment and or in terms of frustration and so on. The point which we should consider carefully is that our longing for happiness and our aversion from what we consider unhappiness plays a dominant part in our lives. And happiness, we inevitably define out of our organic, physical, sensational experience. Those of us who have been educated, who have intellectual and aesthetic gifts and so on, define happiness in intellectual and such terms. But if you are mindful of your reactions, you will see that those intellectualist definitions are completely defeated by the primitive organic responses that come out of us, according to whether we have gained what we desired or were frustrated. You see, and this business of marriage, because it is rooted fundamentally in physical, sexual fulfillment, which is the only spontaneous creative ability that we have, or rather I should say procreative ability that we have, and a state in which we can be completely lost, so to say, in the realization of fulfillment. Because it is that, it is tied up with the deep unconscious innermost awareness within us, of transcendence within us, that it is fundamentally creative. And creative action, this ceaseless creative activity which produces the whole universe, is the supreme sign, characteristic, by which we know and understand the ultimate power that there is in this world in which we live. That is why. Now it is important for us really to understand this, because this creative activity is a creative pulsation. We have considered this a few times during this year and last year too. It's a creative pulsation which utterly transcends all our criteria, our evaluations, our judgments, what we hold dear or not dear. In this creative pulsation, totality manifests, and whatsoever we see happening in that totality comes into being and manifests. The pulsation itself is totally unconcerned with what we see and what we associate with it. And our seeing and association is the source of our feelings and emotions and experiences of pleasure, contentment, fulfillment, or sorrow, frustration, misery, and so on. You see, our fulfillment, our fruition as human beings, therefore, does not lie in our limited conceptions of things. Our fruition and fulfillment lies only in so far as we are able to be altogether free of the tyranny of our thoughts, feelings, ideas, beliefs, systems, doctrines, and the whole host of them, and be in line, in rhythm, in harmony, in tune, use whichever word you like, with this great creative pulse, bearing in mind that the creative pulse right throughout the manifested universe has its own appropriate expression. This is where our human values, moral and spiritual, come in. Because it is only in so far as those values are expressed perfectly that our particular task and contribution as human beings to the correct, the right expression of this creative pulse throughout the universe takes place. If we can really see this, we answer the question, what is the purpose of our existence? And you see, the fulfillment of the purpose of our existence is a task fraught with extreme difficulty, because it is the mind which obtains the vision of the perfect on the one hand, and it is the mind which is the slave of desire on the other hand, and desire springs up basically from our physical organic existence. Bear in mind that the physical organism is an animal organism. Our vision completely transcends that which the animal in us throws up. But all our energy, which is psychophysical, electrochemical, is of an animal nature. And every cell in the body bears this animal impress. But the vision which the mind can put forth utterly transcends this. But we do not know that transcending does not mean overcoming, conflicting with that which tries to remain at a level which does not in itself fully express or perfectly express this transcendent vision. This is where our difficulty lies. These are the things we have to appreciate, really to understand. What is the test? What is the evidence that one has really understood? The test comes in everyday life, doesn't it? All through the day, there are situations, there are circumstances, and especially those of us who live in what we call the advanced states in the world, cultured, busy, and all the rest of it, and worst of all, those of us who live in large cities, we have such a plethora of stimuli coming at us, being thrown at us, crushing us almost, knocking us down, because of the pressure, what we commonly call the pressure of life, that we tend to react more often than not animal fashion. We snarl back and bite, or try to. And our neighbor does the same. And the system does the same. And so you see, we are caught in this awful testing ground, which is ordinary, everyday life and existence. And it is all tied up with our organic existence. Now, if we care for the religious life, if we really care for the realization of transcendence, the kingdom of heaven, nirvana, moksha, Garudimana of the Zarathustrians, call it what you like. If we really care for it, then that care has to deal with this situation which is aggravated by the conflict and struggle of the organism, born of the organism, I mean. This is our difficulty. This is something which shows us every moment of the day just where we stand. It cuts us down to size, so to say. We have beautiful ideas and all the rest of it, noble aspirations, sincere urges towards the highest and the best. We do certain things to help us in order to fulfill that. But to what extent is there the actual realization? Notice very carefully throughout the day the reactions which go out of us. They are mostly antagonistic to the world around us. Let us consider for a moment why they are antagonistic. To put it in a simple sentence, it is because the world is something not exactly what we would wish it to be. The world not being what we would wish it to be, we wish it otherwise. And when we wish that which actually is to be otherwise, there is always an antagonism. And where it is associated with a violent reaction from within us, there is the outgoing anger and hate, condemnation. Now, it's extremely difficult to be so mindful that this violent reaction will not come out. But there is no escape, if one wants to live the religious life, from the practice of mindfulness, watchfulness, to the nth degree. One might say, and as a matter of fact, so many people have said to me alone, and think of the thousands who must have said it to thousands of others, but I do practice mindfulness. I've tried for 20 years, 40 years, and I am not much foreigner. The question is, how have I practiced mindfulness? If you take the trouble to look really deeply into it, you will find that we practice mindfulness desirously in order to produce a particular end. It is not a pure mindfulness. There is always the self tied up in it. I am practicing mindfulness because the Buddha said, or so-and-so taught, that the practice of mindfulness will bring the state of peace and poise and strength and harmony within. I want a result. That I wanting a result defeats the whole thing. Why? Because in my subconscious, there is this I craving for the result, and if it doesn't come, that subconscious kicks before I can be mindful about my subconscious. See, this is how it happens. But now, this is where the intellectual vision plays its part. If the intellectual part of the mind has seen really clearly, coolly, this pulse of creation and its significance, and the absolutely objective fact that everything that there exists in the universe comes to fulfillment only insofar as it is living, acting, vibrating in tune with this creative pulse, is there fulfillment for this thing. When the intellect sees that with sufficient strength, it helps the actual process of mindfulness and enables the mindfulness to be pure. This is one of the great difficulties, there's no doubt about it. I know from a lifetime of experience about it. It's extremely difficult. But then, when our sights are set correctly, and what matters is not my fulfillment or your fulfillment or anything, but the coming to fruition of transcendence, of reality, of truth, or call it what you like, through you, when that becomes sufficiently strong, there is an inward peace and poise which enables the mindfulness to function undisturbed. It is because that inward peace and poise is not there that the mindfulness is like, it's like a straw blown about by the wind. And it fails. Take a simple case in life. We all have certain natural psychic sensitivities. We sense the atmosphere, the psychical atmosphere around us, either of a group or a particular individual. That is to say, we sense something. How accurate is that sensing? One meets somebody and one feels, oh, I don't know, there's something curious about that person. He doesn't like me. He hates me. He probably hadn't the slightest thought or idea about me in the matter. He happens to be a man who has a face which is perhaps a little bit dour. And when he looks at me, it's not exactly Prince Charming smiling at me, and I get the wrong impression. And I go and misbehave towards him on the basis of that wrong impression. See, this sort of situation comes up every day in life. Unless we live in a cave by ourselves and visit the next man in the next cave once in 20 years. Unless we do that, every day of our lives we come up against this. And we come up against it with our friends, with our dear ones too. We constantly get wrong impressions. Now, what are the factors in me myself responsible for the production of those wrong impressions? Quite simply again, I'm expecting something from the other person. I'm desiring something from him. I'm wishing that it shall be thus and thus and not thus and thus. You see the meaning of that word tanha, which the Buddha uses, craving, which is born out of the more generalized vedana, feeling. And so, our task is by no means easy. We must never minimize the difficulty of the task in living the religious life, the holy life. So, it is always a question of going to the root of our difficulties, which is always oneself, fundamentally oneself. One may say, but in life, when you are dealing with other people, they being independent individuals on their own are independent factors producing the situation. Perfectly true. If a person wishes to be nasty to me, or he gets annoyed with me, or he can't stand me, as we say, and he is all the time throwing out discordant feelings, It makes it difficult for me. But if I do happen to have the ability to see truly enough, deeply enough, and myself am poised, not indifferent to the other person, but truly poised, truly comprehending, and therefore wholly compassionate and understanding of that person, then my mindfulness is never lost. Mindfulness is present, and the power for real harmony is generated out of oneself. It may not come about because the other person, who is an independent individual, always has the, as we commonly say, the right, and also the natural incapacity to be harmonious with oneself. So he will continue to do that. Some dogs never stop barking. It's like that. They're always making a noise. But oneself can maintain the poise. And as we have tried to see, the root of the maintenance of that poise is the freedom from our own particular wishes. That the situation should be thus and thus and not thus and thus. Now, when pure mindfulness prevails, then there is no separation between what we commonly call the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. The mind is a whole mind. It is unified. It is a unified mind. And that unified mind is the condition in which one is in tune with the creative pulse. This is very subtle, and it is also very simple. If the seeing by the intellect, the cool, cold seeing by the intellect, plus the warm feeling by the heart, are in harmony, then the thing happens, and there is fruition and fulfillment. The state of fruition and fulfillment. Now we'll see, therefore, that the state of fruition and fulfillment is not my fruition and fulfillment. Because look carefully into what one means by saying my fruition and fulfillment. The gratification of a desire. That is all it means. And that is a thing of time. It is temporal. It is ephemeral. It comes into being and passes away. And once again, we are in a mess and in misery. So, when this creative pulse comes to fruition through the particular individual, for that individual and his environment, there is the state of fruition and fulfillment. And that is the state of creative activity, which completely includes what the world would call inaction. In that state of stillness and silence, a mode of activity goes on which is utterly transcendent to all our busyness, our fussiness, our confusion and disorder producing activity in the world. It is utterly transcendent to that. The world will call it inaction, but that is true action. Because the universal flow of life goes on as a pellucid stream and not as a muddied stream under those circumstances. And then you will find that no conflicts arise inside. There are no tears which are related to one's own sense of frustration or misery. There is no external excitement which passes under the name of, oh, we had a wonderful time, so joyful, shouting with joy. You can be joyous without the shouting. So you'll find that all these external ephemeral wrappings which veil and hide the truth will have vanished. And then you don't see the truth. You are the truth. This is the difference. In our ignorant state, we seek to become this, that, and the other. The simple-minded religious man, in his heart of hearts, seeks to become the saint, the pure one. You can never become the saint like that. You just are the saint, provided the devilishness is out. And the devilishness is out when there is this pure mindfulness, this pure watchfulness. And saintship, as I've said dozens of times in these years, is the beginning, not the culmination, of the religious life, the spiritual life. It is the beginning. Because in finality, where man is concerned, he handles power all the time that he's alive. He cannot avoid it. I mean, the mere act of decision in the morning that we will do such and such business or we'll cook such and such a meal means that you're manipulating energy, power. You're handling power all the time. The man who is a saint, spontaneously, naturally, unconsciously, will handle power in a saintly way. That is all. He'll handle it rightly. Not mishandle it, as all the world does. And that, again, is the happy state. To handle power rightly, because there is the basis of complete purity within oneself. This is the meaning of the religious life. You know, this ties up again with looking into the reasons why we seek disciplines. Look very carefully at the motive. It will always be camouflaged under wonderful altruistic names and forms. Oh, it's not for me, it's for the sake of the world, the sake of God, or anything big. Is it? How do I, the finite mortal, know at all what is for the sake of God, or the infinite, or the transcendent? What extraordinary presumption and conceit. Say nothing of sheer stupidity. There are thousands and thousands of people in the world, and they have existed through the ages, who are quite convinced that they are doing this in the name of God for the promotion of God's work and all the rest of it. Good heavens, they must be little gods themselves to be so high up. You see how easy it is for us to suffer from that kind of conceit. It's very easy. And we seek disciplines in order to become the worthy servant of the Lord. How do we know that the discipline is the right one if we are not there at all? We have no means of knowing. You see, we are not really particularly intelligent in this matter. We don't take into account what we do know and can know. What I do know and can know is the mess I make. I don't know the thing in perfection. So, when I draw up my plans, convinced that the perfect thing is that, and this plan will take me to that perfect thing, I'm a first-class fool. Took me 60 years of existence to see it, at least 60 years. What I do know is what goes wrong. That is why I seek at all. When you naturally do something perfectly and easily, supposing you run beautifully or swim beautifully, just naturally it comes to you easily. You don't plan about it. You just do it. It happens. It happens naturally, spontaneously, beautifully, graciously, and unself-consciously. It is transcendence swimming in the water, not I or you. Now, you might say, but good gracious, this is awful. Surely there must be ways and means of helping ourselves to get on. Well, all right, don't define the get on. Be aware of what is not right. And it is impossible for anyone not to be aware of what is not right, because it hurts. It hurts me, you, my friends, everything around me. It makes a mess. And unless I'm dead, even if I have half of one of the five senses left to me, I'll know that I'm making a mess. That much I can see, and that's what I can deal with. Now, that's the job you have to get on with. You know, the old teachers did teach just this sort of thing, but it's been peculiarly forgotten and misinterpreted. And do you know why it has been forgotten and misinterpreted? When the great ones, the holy ones, died, their disciples, their followers, God strafe them, organized the holy ones' teaching. Made a straitjacket of it in order to produce a result. And that is what produced damnation. So they watered it down, they spoilt it, they covered it over with their ignorance, and they appealed to the greed of man. Come on, boy, you do this, and such marvelous results will come for you and for all of us. Onward, godly soldiers. No. Do look into this really clearly and get free of the cobwebs. Each person's discipline emerges out of himself. If the life urge from within is allowed to flow naturally towards its fulfillment, then it will lighten up the mind, and the mind will see, yes, yes, this is the thing to do, and you do it. And of course, one does it imperfectly, because we are all imperfect and we remain imperfect for a very, very long time. But each of these imperfections will show up. And then we'll see, ah, no, not quite like this, but like that. No, not like that, but like that, like that, like that. And so you go on growing. Discipline is learning by growing. I used this phrase a few months ago, you remember. It is not learning by conforming to what is told you. What is told you may inspire you, may suggest something to you. And if the response from within is your own spontaneous live response, then it is all right for you. If that were not the case, then no one could talk to another and do anything for him at all. But one can talk together, one can consider together. Remember, consider is far profounder than just talking. One can consider together and be inspired in the right way. There is the right way of inspiration. Not to be carried away by another, but to be lighted up from within by the impulse, the stimulus from the other. That can happen. But beware of being caught in the conditioning. We are all always willing to allow, to let ourselves be caught because we'll get a result. No. So now, from the royal wedding, we have come through all this. But for everyone, every single one, there is a royal wedding which takes place every moment of one's existence. There is the call of the transcendent perpetually there. But remember, it is always non-compulsive. It doesn't compel. The call is there. And if I wake up to that call, and I can wake up to that call in the real sense and in the complete sense only if there is no self involved in it, no vested interest involved in it, then this royal wedding takes place perpetually. It's a timeless happiness. It's a timeless bliss. And whatever the external circumstance, and the conflict and the struggle which the world throws up against us, we will feel the pain and the difficulty of that, of course. But this royal wedding will go on unhindered. And in that, there is happiness, the real happiness, which I experience like the unconscious, spontaneous child in the state of complete innocence. It's just happy, but it doesn't know it is happy. It's the grown-up who sees and says, oh, isn't that child happy? And it is the grown-ups who teach the child the word happiness, and oh, that was happiness, and this was happiness. And it slightly spoils us for growing up and realizing our total maturity.